Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's teleconference, ARS Outlook Conference Call. All lines will be muted for the duration of the call. With that, I'll turn the call over to ARS Investment Partners. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Tom Friedman wrote that the three most powerful forces today are technological advances, globalization, and climate change. They're redefining all aspects of our lives, politically, socially, and economically. At the same time, the rate of change is faster than it's ever been, and it's only accelerating. We all see how it's disorienting for people, and it's been distracting attention away from the strengths that are present in the system. On Friday, the S&P 500 index changed the classification of 26 companies: Google, Facebook, Disney, Netflix, Comcast, just to name a few. Over $3 trillion of changes were made just to reflect the changing realities of the environment. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Schmeidler, and welcome to the ARS Investment Partners conference call. Today, we are going to be discussing our recent investment outlook called Making Sense of the Changing Structure of U.S. Equity Markets. Overall, we're finding very exciting opportunities within the market, while others continue to underestimate these opportunities. At the same time, the U.S. economy is strong and also being underestimated in our view, and the economic expansion is likely to extend for quite some time. At the same time, we are monitoring the situation with respect to the trade conflict between the U.S. and China, but at the same time, we're also monitoring the powerful U.S. economy, which is supported by significant tax cuts, deficit spending, the repatriation of massive U.S. profits that have been accumulated for many years and that's flowing back to our shores. This money is coming back in the form of share buybacks, dividend increases, and business capital spending, which is increasing, and importantly, should add to higher productivity for the U.S. economy. At the same time, the market's daily activity and focus is more and is ever more so on price movements and not on business fundamentals. This, we see, continuing to open up greater opportunity for us to invest in strong, growing businesses at attractive valuations. With respect to investing, we continue to favor technology, including the cloud, mobility, communications, semiconductors, data storage, and security. Healthcare, including biotechnology, defense companies, select energy companies, and small cap companies. On today's call, I'm joined by my partners, Arnold Schmeidler, Ross Taylor, and Michael Shannon. They'll be sharing thoughts on the outlook and representative investment holdings. I want to thank you all for joining us on this call and for the trust and the confidence that you place in us every day. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Arnold.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and good morning, good afternoon. Thank you all for being on this call for us. Let me start by breaking down our approach to the issue of investing in the securities markets. First thing we have to define for us is the outlook. What is the outlook under which we are making securities selections, buying businesses, shares of businesses, rather than trying to trade the stock market? The second aspect is what is the current market structure with which we have to deal? And the third aspect of this is the fundamentals of investing. To start with the outlook, let's go back about 10 years to the financial crisis. The financial crisis had the very damaging effect of creating powerful deflationary forces both here and around the globe. The only way these deflationary forces could be successfully fought to bring us out of the financial crisis was to have the central banks, the Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, create an interest rate structure that became zero and in Europe actually negative. So in order to bring back the financial system, which was on the verge of collapse, the cost of borrowing had to be virtually eliminated. What this created was a business cycle unlike any cycle that any of us have ever experienced, and unlike any cycle that was experienced in the United States. This is of fundamental importance because so much investment activity today is related to how aspects of the financial environment behave in past cycles. But if this cycle is totally different, then the comparison with past cycles becomes invalid in many respects. So if we look at today's outlook, the United States economy is the strongest economy in the world today. The emerging markets economies have suffered from various significant devaluations, which has had the effect of drawing large amounts of capital from overseas into the United States. Just bear in mind that capital always flows to the highest rate of return. And when we look at our interest rate structure, which is partly the result of a strong economy, a growing economy, as well as a less accommodative Federal Reserve policy that's bringing our interest rates closer to what is a normal rate. So our rates, for example, 10-year U.S. Treasury rates at 2.82% roughly, will compare to a German rate, which is negative. The 2-year German rate is a minus 50 basis points. So it is no wonder that capital will flow into the United States and into the United States economy, as well as financing what is a record high U.S. budget deficit, fiscal budget deficit, at the top or closer to the top of the United States business cycle, also an unheard of characteristic. And yet our interest rates have not behaved with all of this fiscal stimulus to give us a level that's significantly higher than what it is today. The reason being, number one, foreign capital coming into the U.S. market. Number two, the repatriation of at least $1.5 to $2 trillion of overseas capital, which goes into U.S. corporations, buying back stock, increasing dividends, investing in technology, increasing capital spending. And so the financial dynamics of the United States economy are very strong under these kinds of conditions, which leads us to recognize that inflation rates will continue to be on the low side, even though they're moving up somewhat, because we have the ability to produce more efficiently as more capital goes into the business sector. Bear in mind that also the interest in advancing technology, namely the coming 5G, the mobility of devices, the demand for cloud, as Andrew was mentioning earlier, all tends to keep the pricing structure on the low side, the competitive pricing structure low. Amazon is a great example. So the deflationary forces remain still quite powerful, even though we have somewhat rising inflation. Now, the three elements that power the U.S. economy are consumer spending, government spending, and business spending. Consumer spending has benefited from a growing economy. Government spending is benefiting from record high deficits. And business spending is going into capital of technology, which is, again, to create more efficiency. Now, combine that with Federal Reserve policy, which is still quite accommodative. The Fed has a very special responsibility in today's environment for this economy. It has to make sure that the business cycle we are in lasts for an extended period of time. And let us emphasize how important that is, because we're running a fiscal deficit of over $1 trillion. The last thing the United States economy and our society can afford is to have a recession, a significant downturn in economic activity, which will only worsen the fiscal position of the country, as well as unfunded, underfunded pension funds, state budgets, et cetera. The only way the United States can handle the kind of deficit spending we have, in our view, is for the expansion to continue for a very significant period of time. We believe the Federal Reserve is very well aware of this, keenly aware of this, and is taking modest steps to normalize the interest rate structure that they want to normalize. The reason they want to have a better structure is very simple: to be able to deal with any downturn when it comes in the future, so that there will be a range of interest rate reductions that they can achieve, because rates are close to zero, there isn't much they can do. So they want to get themselves in a position of being able to manage any softening in economic demand quite successfully. So we look at the three elements of common stock valuation, which are interest rates, inflation rates, and corporate profits, in a positive way. Interest rates will tend to go up, but not to a level that's going to be difficult. Inflation rates will stay contained, in our view, even though they will rise a little bit, which is also healthy. And corporate profits will continue to rise. Now, if we look at the second part of what we're discussing here, which is market structure. In 1998, publicly traded shares were 7,000. Today, in 2017, let's say, 3,500. In 1960, there were 161 mutual funds, $17 billion. In 2017, there weren't 161, there were 7,956, worth over $18 trillion. In 2003, ETFs, exchange-traded funds, numbered 120, and they are now over 1,700. And the computerization of the market has led to this concept of high-frequency trading, which enables a great deal of capital to move in and out of securities at very high volumes and very high speeds to capture very small price changes. And it's estimated that 80 to 90% of trading volume is traded this way. And so the average holding period for a New York Stock Exchange stock has gone from 8.3 years in 1960 to 1.2 years in 2000, and it's lower today. And high-frequency trading, which accounts for such a large volume of securities traded, now has holding periods that range from 11 to 22 seconds. In other words, price movements have come to dominate investment thinking rather than the fundamentals of a business. And this disconnect between price and fundamentals has created an opportunity for those active investors who can take advantage of the market conditions that are created. Which leads us to the third element, which is the fundamentals of investing. The markets for us are a medium of exchange. They're not something we're trying to predict. Nobody can really predict the market. It's not a casino. We don't trim securities and say we're taking money off the table. That's a casino concept. As a medium of exchange, it's an auction market. And in an auction market, if you are right and in the minority in the security you're investing in, you will generate the highest rate of return. Let me repeat that. If you are in the minority and you are right, you're going to generate the highest rate of return. Our fundamental approach is to buy the most future earnings, cash flow, and assets for the fewest dollars. Let me define cash flow. Cash flow is a better number than earnings. Earnings is a product of the accounting profession. Cash flow is what the company has left at the end of the year that's greater than what it started with. Cash flow from operations is the lifeblood of a business. And our focus is on buying as much cash flow for as few dollars as possible, with the understanding that the more a company earns, and the more cash flow it generates, the more it will be worth. Now, it takes time for companies to earn money and generate cash flow. And the more cash flow that's generated and the more earnings that's generated over a period of time will give us a higher valuation. Well, let's put it differently. The company will be worth more. And what the market pays for that, we cannot predict. All we can say is that the more a company earns, the more a company will be worth. The other element of valuation is the idea of price-earnings ratios. What is the ratio, what is the price in related to the earnings of a company? And we always use, and we hear, it's selling at a discount to the S&P 500. What does that mean? Well, if you look at the characteristics of the S&P average, Standard & Poor's average, you look at their return on equity, look at the profit margins, look at the debt equity ratio, look at the earnings, and when you compare an individual business to the characteristics of the S&P 500, and if those characteristics of the individual business are far superior to the S&P, and it's not selling at the S&P, but at a bigger discount, at a discount to the S&P, that, all other things being equal, would constitute an undervalued security. And so what our focus is to look for companies that benefit from the outlook, because the outlook is fundamental to where capital will flow. Look at companies that benefit from the outlook and buy the ones that have the clearest, and this is a matter of judgment because this is an art, this is not a science, it's a combination, but there's a lot of art involved that's based upon judgment, experience, and unlike computer-generated activity, which is artificial intelligence or machine learning, that's not based on judgment of the future. So our idea is, like any businessman, you want to buy the best business for the fewest dollars. That is what's generating our interest in specific sectors of the economy and specific companies. Bear in mind, and I repeat it again, the more a company will earn, the more it will be worth. Patience is a requirement. And this leads us to my final conclusion for us, is that there's a big difference between absolute and relative returns. We are always after absolute returns. That's what pays the bills for us, for our clients. And by the way, we invest in the same companies that we invest in for our clients. Absolute rate of return means exactly that. Relative rates of return only mean that you will do better than the market if you could predict the market, which we don't believe is predictable. But if the market is down 10% and we're down 5%, we've done relatively quite well. For us, that's totally unsatisfactory. That takes away the entire focus that you want to buy companies that will give you an absolute rate of return, and that can include dividends as well. So at this point, let me turn it over to Ross, our esteemed colleague, and Ross, if you will continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Arnold. As Arnold said, we are investors. More than that, we're high conviction investors. This means that we're comfortable taking a longer view on a company than the market often does. And it means that at times we will come to a very different conclusion about the value of that company's shares than the market has come to. But largely, this is because the market does a lot of its thinking in the past. It looks backwards for how it determines stocks should trade, as opposed to what we do, which is look forward to determine how much a company should earn. In the quarter that ends Friday, while our fundamental investment thesis has not changed, some of our names have seen the market take a view that's somewhat divergent from ours. Among the names that fall into this category in the quarter that's just ending are the memory stocks, the semiconductors, and the semi-cap equipment companies. In no segment of the market has the difference in outlook between those whose trading is driven by looking back at past correlations and those whose trading is investing is driven by looking forward to the evolving economy been greater than in the area of semiconductors and memory stocks. Historically, this segment has seen wide swings in revenues and profitability because of its heavy reliance on the PC sector and what is simply often irrational pricing by competitors. We believe that the growth of the Internet of Things, with everything from smart cars and smartphones to 5G and appliances needing increasing levels of memory, is broadening the sources of demand for memory chips. We believe that demand is only going to grow as more and more devices get linked into the Internet and more devices become smart. We believe these broadening sources of demand, along with a consolidation inside the industry, which is now down to only a handful of major players, will create for the memory space a much longer and also a much shallower cycle than we have seen historically. We believe this means that companies should see substantially higher trough earnings than has historically been the case. In the past, these stocks have tended to trade at roughly 15 times trough earnings, and trough earnings here would be the earnings a company generates at the worst part of its industrial cycle. We currently see stocks in the memory space trading at anywhere from 4 to 10 times the next 12 months' earnings. Spot memory prices have been coming down, yet earnings for these companies have held in very well because of continued high demand and the company's ability to continually reduce their cost structures. When you look at this segment in the market today, stocks are pricing in for an environment that we saw at the bottom of the last cycle. And in fact, for us to achieve the kind of multiples that that last cycle saw, we would need to see earnings drops in the next 2 to 4 quarters for these stocks of between 60 and 75% versus what the current expectations are. A number of names in our portfolio that fall into this sector include Western Digital, which is a major player in computer memory. Western Digital trades at 5.4 times 2018 estimated numbers and 5.3 times next year's estimated numbers. In the last 12 months, Western Digital has generated over $11 a share in free cash flow, giving it a free cash flow yield of nearly 20%. A free cash flow yield is a number you come up with when you basically turn an equity stock into a bond. So if you were to think of Western Digital as a bond right now, the market would be telling you that you'd be getting a 20% yield on that bond. Another player in the memory space is Micron. Micron trades at an even lower PE, only 4 times 2018 estimated earnings. Micron has $2.7 billion in net cash on the balance sheet, is looking to buy back $10 billion of its shares, which is 20% of its current market cap, It generated over $7 a share in free cash flow in the last 12 months, which is a 16% free cash yield. A third name in this space is Cypress. Cypress is an important player in the Internet of Things. It trades at about 11 times this year's estimated earnings per share and 10 times next year's. Cypress is an important component supplier to a number of key industries, including electronic devices, wireless communication, infotainment, and autos, and should benefit strongly as we move into the new generation, including autonomous driving. Additionally, there was a transaction of one of Cypress's primary competitors that was done at 2 times the metrics that Cypress is currently trading at. When you look at this sector, I'd like you to step back for a second and think. These are the stocks that are at the center of what is called the revolution of the Internet of Things. Yet these stocks are trading at earnings multiples of 1/2 to 1/3 of those of the total market. An additional area where we see the market not embracing our current outlook has been the defense stocks. In the last decade, the U.S. has been focused on fighting an asymmetrical war in the Near and Middle East. During the same time, the Russians and the Chinese have been rapidly advancing their capabilities in areas such as missiles and combat aircraft to a level where, by some accounts, their current state-of-the-art systems outstrip our own technologies. A senior United States admiral recently testified in front of Congress that it is his concern that large parts of the South China Sea would become are a no-go area in the event of an armed conflict against China. In this space, one of our favorite names is Raytheon. Raytheon produces a wide variety of programs for the Department of Defense, but it's best known for its capabilities in radar and anti-missile systems. These two areas, known as detect and defeat, are of growing importance as Russia and China are both bringing into service new platforms with much greater capabilities than previous generations. Recent Chinese missile rollouts have included hypersonic weapons that have the range to hit targets in Guam when fired from inland China in seconds. Raytheon sells at just under 21 times this year's estimated earnings and less than 18 times next year's, a multiple roughly in line with that of the market for a company which is a strong generator of free cash flow, has a basically debt-free balance sheet, and a very well-respected management team. Additionally, it's operating in a sector where programs can have lives measured in decades, not months or years, which makes it very unique in the market and the economy today. In our focused small cap strategy, we have a number of very exciting names that are largely off the market's radar screen at this point in time. Among the most interesting of these is ChemBio Diagnostics. ChemBio develops and markets point-of-care rapid tests for a variety of diseases, including HIV and many tropical diseases, using a unique DPP technology, which allows both greater accuracy as well as the ability to put multiple tests onto a single panel, which means that if you're getting one of these tests, you can literally get tested for as many as 9 diseases with one drop of blood. Among the projects ChemBio is currently developing point-of-care tests for are a syphilis-HIV combination test for here in the U.S. where syphilis is exploding, a dengue, malaria, and other tropical disease tests in conjunction with the Gates Foundation. Additionally, they're doing a similar project for the Allen Foundation, for Biomangenus, which is a Brazilian company, and for, in the U.S. for BARDA. They're working on creating a point-of-care test that will, in 10 minutes, be able to tell you whether you have certain types of cancer. They've been shortlisted for a Hep C test. They're developing a concussion test, which literally would allow you to determine if someone's had a concussion within minutes. They're also working on flu, as well as a number of other undisclosed areas for companies such as AstraZeneca, Find, and Lumera DX, as well as the CDC here in the U.S. Many of ChemBio's initiatives offer revenue opportunities equal to or greater than what the company as a whole generated in 2017. We think of ChemBio as being a late-stage venture cap company, which has already has a proven technology which is in the marketplace generating revenues. Products already approved and in the market alone can drive a doubling of earnings over the next 3 to 4 years. This is a very well-managed company, and it has recently added to its depth on its management team. It's using its DPP technology to gain greater and greater acceptance from a wide variety of customers, and it's opened up meaningful growth opportunities. In fact, when we look out over the 2017 to the 2021 timeframe, it would not surprise us if it were to triple its revenues over that period. Yet in spite of this, today, ChemBio was trading at a segment average price to sales multiple. So if it turns out that we're right in our estimates of what it can do on the top line, investors should be able to see very meaningful return from today's stock prices. These are just a few of the names that make up our portfolios. But in summary, we're very excited about our portfolios. We're very excited about the companies in which we're invested. We recognize that some of them are out of step with the market right now, but we believe that time is going to prove to be our ally against the market's short-term focus that has acted as a drag on names like those I just talked about. Now I'm going to pass it back to Michael, who will try to pull all this together.
Thanks very much. We constantly talk about the fact that when people are suggesting or considering giving us assets to manage for them, the question that inevitably comes up from those particularly who are more cynical is, what makes you people so different? What do you do that not every other manager on Wall Street does? And the good news is that we believe that there are two or three things we do that does distinguish us from them. Number one, and I bet that you'll say you've noticed it just in this presentation, we love what we do. We are passionate investors. We are passionate about what we can do for our clients to increase their net worths and enrich their lives. Just as an example of that, you will find that unlike some of our colleagues elsewhere who arrive at work anywhere between 8:30 and 10 o'clock, we are generally, a number of us are here between 7 and 7:30. The first thing we do is to devour the four largest financial newspapers, cover to cover. We then adjourn at 8:30 with the entire crew, where we go over what we've read, what we pick up. We have lively disputes about who believes what about what they heard. And it is an atmosphere that encourages very free thinking and, frankly, friendly combat, verbal, of course. The second thing is that our Outlook, which is our firm's primary publication, which we issue 6 to 8 times a year, is not, unlike many of our colleagues elsewhere, backward thinking. We think you don't need us to tell you what happened last quarter and why it happened that way. By that time, you already know it, hopefully. We are looking forward. You just heard both Arnold and Andrew and Ross talk about what causes these things to happen, what happens globally, what happens here in the United States, just about every facet of the financial world. We want to make some educated, perhaps, guesses, but they're based on a very deep amount of knowledge and experience that we've had collectively. This allows us to issue a publication that gives us a good basis for where we want to direct our targets, where we think capital flows will most likely be going, and give us what we think is a very big leg up on those who are, if you will, looking the other direction and trying to make decisions based on what happened before. The third thing is, as I said, the passion for investing, which drives this all to happen and which creates an atmosphere that is extremely conducive to fertile thinking and being willing to take chances. We are very, I believe Ross said, we are very much interested in what's going to be going forward, and that's where we spend our time and effort. Finally, and I think this may be the most important thing of all, what you will sense in this firm is another passion, and that is to take care of our clients. We believe that is a very near sacred duty. We think that what the securities that we buy for ourselves are exactly the securities we want to buy for our clients as well, and that is what we do. We have no conflicts of interest in this firm. We drive all of our efforts towards making sure that we are increasing the net worths of our clients, and that's what we do. You will also see that we have multi-generational client bases. We have been in this business for a very long time, and we have had the pleasure of managing the assets of families, all iterations of those families, for a very long period of time, which is very, very exciting for us and very gratifying. Hopefully that gives you an idea of why we are so proud of what we've created here and the atmosphere that we have. Andrew, please, it's your turn.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ross and Arnold, for your comments today. We have a few minutes, and we wanted to have the opportunity to address questions that any of you may have. So on that note, if we can open up the open it up back to you, Kyle, if you could queue up the line and see if there are any questions available out there that wish to be asked.
As we move forward to the Q&A portion of today's call, please feel free to place yourself into the question queue by pressing #2 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a notification when your line is unmuted. At that time, please then state your name and question. Once again, pressing #2 will indicate that you wish to ask a question. And we'll give it a moment.
Okay, in the meantime, we received a question by email from a client that we can we'd like to ask on your behalf. And the question is, when your views and the market's view of an investment are divergent, how far out do you look to determine your patience in buying or holding the investment? Ross, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. Thank you, Andrew. I think that how long one is willing to be out of sync with the market on an investment is largely determined by a couple of factors. The first is how we view the risk-reward profile of that stock. In other words, what do we see the upside to be versus what do we see the near-term downside risk to be? You're really much more willing to wait for a stock where you see 100% or more upside to develop the story as long as the fundamentals continue to work out than you would be for one where your upside is perceived to only be 10 or 15%. A second factor we will take into consideration is the probability that our case is the winning scenario. When you invest, as we do, you often have a scenario or a thesis behind that investment, such as when I was talking about the memory stocks. We'll watch pricing, we'll watch profitability, and we'll use these factors to determine whether or not the investment is still tracking to our expectations or whether it has derailed in an adverse sense. When an investment no longer is making sense fundamentally, we will exit it. And the last one is just that, is how long or is the company continuing to execute on its plans? Is it doing for us what we expect it to do? Is it doing what it told us it was going to do? And as long as a company is executing, we find that generally the market will move back. As Arnold was saying, it's all about free cash flow. It's all about profit. So when you're watching a company, as long as it continues to make money, as long as it continues to generate substantial free cash flow, as long as the top line is growing as you expected or better, then if the market doesn't like it, we'll actually do what Buffett always told us we're supposed to do, which is we'll look to perhaps buy more, or we're unlikely necessarily to eliminate the position because of the fact that the upside can often be so much greater than expected when these tides turn.
Thank you, Ross. Kyle, are there any questions now on the line?
No questions have come in.
Okay, very well. Well, we want to thank everyone for joining us today on this call. And if you have some questions that you want to ask us one-on-one, we invite you to please contact us. We appreciate it very much, and we appreciate your time that you've spent with us today and the relationship. So this concludes today's call. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
Thank you for joining today's teleconference. The call has now concluded, and you may disconnect.